this? What's your operating number?
Hello there. I'm Eric Doa Lonquist. I've been an esports caster for 13 years or something like that. And I've played competitive card games pretty much all my life. Well, since I was 10 or 11, so close enough. And yeah, happy to be here.
Hello there.
General Kenobi.
Hello there, indeed. A special edition of Hello There this week, as I figured...
I'm not that special.
Well, you're very special, Doa. You're special. You're special enough, Doa, wherein we were two, and we increased the full-on capacity of Ice Cave Radio by 50%, because we felt that this was absolutely a better-than-the-sum-of-our-parts scenario, and now
wow.
You're here.
Wow. Well, it's been great. I've been kind of sporadic on the show, you know, with all the moving and the baby stuff and all that. But I'm glad to kind of be back to normal now, you know, as far as like being on the show goes.
Well, welcome. Welcome indeed.
And thank you.
I do want to open with this, because this kind of snuck in just at the deadline under the professor's door of the office. That was my tactic, by the way. Always worked.
Wow.
Yeah. When you miss the deadline for a paper, the mm-hmm. the pro move was to slide it under the your professor's office door in the faculty area. Not
yeah.
that day. That's the rookie move. You go on a weekend and you slide it under and you push it really hard, so that when they ask you, "I didn't get your paper on time," I said, "I slid it under the door. Maybe you didn't see it." And then they'd find it in a corner, and I'd be like, "I'm sorry, I couldn't make it to class that day." And so I just had to come in and slide in. It worked 80% of the time.
We always, even though like I graduated in like 2005 or 6 from college, like we still emailed everything at that point. So I don't know, like maybe my professors were just cooler, but I remember emailing like a lot of papers at like 11:59 p.m. you know, on the day it was due. Like I definitely did that a lot. I was not valedictorian.
it's weird for me, because the anxiety that I used to not have back then about deadlines is completely different. Now that I don't have grades associated to things, now I'm like more terrified about missing deadlines and getting things prepared and such. If I went back to school today, Doa, if they assigned me a paper and they're like, "Oh, it's only due at the end of the month," I'd have it done by midnight the day after, because I would just be too freaked out about life. That's just me.
I've never been able to do that. I'm always like, get it done at the last. I need that pressure. Like, I don't know. I feel like I'm one of those people that like works better when they have that pressure. You know, if it's like something's coming up and it's like, you know, 2 weeks from now, I'll be like, yeah, I'll get to that like 3 days before.
Yeah. No.
You know, like I've gotten better. I'm not like that with your work stuff. Right. But like, you know, taxes and anything else. Like all the like busy work, all the like little stuff that like that you have to end up getting done, I always like leave that to last minute, which is bad because then it all piles up, right? I should just be spreading it out over time and doing it, but I've just accepted that I'm never going to figure that out. That's just one part of life I'm always going to get wrong. I can't help it.
It's what it is. But all this to say is we got a message from Bad Swoo Art saying, "I don't have any questions for you, Doa. I just want to say how cool it is that I think you're here. I got into League of Legends and League of Legends esports when Season 3 World Championships happened at the Staples Center. It was the start of the Faker era." I know
2013.
That name.
Yeah.
Even I know that name, Doa. I know Faker. I'm not personally.
He's big.
Apparently so. Big enough that a doofus like me knows who this person is.
Popular guy.
Quote-unquote Korea hype train and the staple of LCK analysis and commentary explaining to us American plebes how and why Korean players were so much better was a duo of Monty and Doa. Now, I've never met Monty, but I know all about him through you, obviously. And just goes and Bad Swoo Art continues onwards. I didn't follow Doa's career after you left League, but just recent moments where I got into Star Wars Unlimited, found Ice Cave Radio, and was like, wait, the Doa? Holy sh! And that's where it got. So she just wanted to convey what a lot of people have said to me and said otherwise, that it's really cool to have you on the show. So I want to give you a big welcome, another official one.
Well, I mean, I'm glad to be here. It's funny, like... doing esports for so long because a lot of people just stick with one game and they'll just do that game forever, you know, and I respect that a lot, but I just felt like I needed to just keep changing it up because I just needed a new challenge, you know. I felt like, because I did mostly play-by-play, right? And so if you're an analyst, you can kind of do one game forever, right? Because there's always going to be meta changes. There's always going to be different things to analyze, right? Whereas if you're play-by-play, even though the game might change, right? And League of Legends refreshes every year, essentially, with like little tweaks to buffs and things. There's always new items, blah, blah, but new champions. But like the fundamentals of casting something as a play-by-play caster, you know, once I felt like I kind of mastered that, it was like, all right, this is fun. What's next, you know? And so I kind of tended to bounce between games and things. And it's funny because people be like that where they're like, oh, well, I watched you in this one game. Like, what did you do after that? And at first when people would say that, I was like, well, I mean, I've still been casting. What you know, I'd feel that way. I'd be like, how would they not? And then I'm like, well, I mean, if I watch, like I watched a lot of basketball in like the 90s, right? But I haven't watched, you know, and you know, but I haven't watched like basketball since then. So anyone who is doing anything at that point, like I don't know what they've done since then, you know. And so I kind of had to be like, oh yeah, yeah. Well, it makes sense. People would follow one sport, you know. If they, you know, why is esports any different than traditional sports? Where like someone is a League of Legends fan, they're not going to necessarily jump over to Overwatch, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to cast a lot of different things. So I have
about. Maybe 15 years ago, I could tell you every stat on any of the major sports other than football. I was never a football guy, but basketball, hockey, baseball, I knew at any given time what anybody's stat line was and their historical stuff. Now forget it. Wow. I was like, finding out that certain players have retired or moved on is like a whole different world to me. But it's fascinating because part of the conversation is one that I actually heard coming from Mitch Leslie, aka Uber, saying that it's a different ball game when you're so intimately linked with a very successful franchise or group and you're getting that consistent work to going to like sort of the grinder house of just taking what comes your way. And that's maybe what a lot of people don't realize is that it's a constant hustle, that those jobs that are reliable, that are consistent, that are, you know, lucrative to that degree of being able to live a life without that kind of worry, those are so few and far between, and nobody's safe. I mean, if you know where we
especially
are
now.
Oh, yeah. Especially now. Yeah. And I want to just ask you a little bit more about what kind of, and this isn't to sort of pump our tires, but you know, being involved with Star Wars Unlimited and whatnot, but it, you know, Charmer and I launched this endeavor of Ice Cave Radio, which was then Wampa Radio, almost a year ago, frankly. I think it was, we're approaching.
You guys started early, yeah.
We did. I mean, almost a week or two after the announcement of the game, we were already acquiring a schedule, locking down domains and stuff like that. When did you hear about us? And when did you want to sort of be involved?
I mean, I'm trying to remember now because I was very excited when the announcement happened. Actually, it's funny. I remember I had just moved to Minnesota last year because we moved from L.A. to the Twin Cities area to be closer to family for the birth of my daughter. She was due in June or early July, actually. She was born in late June. But like so we had just moved to Minnesota. It was like early May. And I was playing Flesh and Blood at like the new local shop that was like near my house. And like one of the people there was like, oh, yeah, there's this new Star Wars card game coming. And I was like, wait, what? Really? And they're like, yeah, Fantasy Flight is making it. And I'm like, really? Because I, you know, I've been a Star Wars card game fan since the 90s. You know, I played the Decipher one endlessly. I competed in tournaments around like, for what it's worth, southern Minnesota, that area, you know, all the rural shops, you know, I'd go from like town to town and compete in those things. So that was very exciting, right? And I played a lot of Fantasy Flight games over the years too, board games and then a lot of card games too. I was, speaking of Monty, he and I were really into the Legend of the Five Rings LCG.
Yeah,
it's such a great game. But we even drove like to Phoenix to play in this like weekend tournament together once and all. So we were like really into it. So when I heard those you know three things combined, I guess I'll say is Star Wars, Fantasy Flight, and card game. I was very excited to hear more. You know, then the announcement happened, and you know, it was super hype, and I think you guys must have been talking about it in our you know, Discord that doesn't exist, you know, for Flesh and Blood. There is no Discord, right? But you know, I heard about this, and I think I just asked. I was like, "Hey, can I be on the show too?" Because like, I know I'm gonna like it. I know I'm gonna want to make content for it. So if you guys are already doing a podcast, you mind adding me in there? And thankfully you said yes. And it's been fun for you. It's been fun for me. So
it's been a lot of fun. And again, a part of it is just multiple perspectives. And you know, Charmer and I have such a wide berth of games and being involved in card games for, you know, casually for myself, you know, 20 some odd years, 25, 26 years. I think since I was 12 years old, I started playing card games. Same with Charmer. You yourself got in, you know, for about the same amount of time. And to us,
next year will be 30 years since I started playing Magic the Gathering, which was the first card game I played.
Which is crazy. Like, coming to think of it, and it's not just a matter of it's crazy that the games have gone this long, but it's crazy that they've kind of captured our attention and have shaped our lives to that degree.
Well, I still remember my first game of Magic the Gathering. I still remember my first card game ever. I remember it distinctly. It was in the cafeteria of a high school that I was going to go to the next year, in a couple of years. I was in sixth grade, I think it was at the time, fifth or sixth grade. My friend who was already in high school was like, "Hey, check out this, you know, look at this game. It's called Magic the Gathering." And he gave me a deck, and he was playing a deck, and he gave me a red deck. And this was revised. It was 95. So it would have been like revised or something like that at that point. So we had like Ball Lightning and Fireball and all that stuff. And I was like, "Oh, this is really cool," because I already like fantasy. You know, I was already a fan of the fantasy genre as far as like reading books. I'd been reading a lot of like Dragonlance and things like that. My dad's a big fantasy fan, so I had, you know, read The Hobbit and, you know, watched a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I was like, "Oh, this game is so cool. Like, the art is really neat." And I liked how we were, you know, playing creatures and playing against each other. And he's like, "Oh, you can build your own deck out of cards. You just have to have some land and you have to have the other cards." And I think that's what really struck me, was that like, I can construct my own deck out of this pool of cards, and it's mine and I built it, and then I can pit my deck that I've built against your deck that you've built, and we can see who's better, you know. So I think I was immediately drawn to the complexity of getting and the ownership too of having this thing that like I built, and to see if what I did was good enough to beat what you did, you know. Because I always, since I can't remember a time where I didn't want to play against people in, you know, video games and things like that, you know. So then when I played this first game, I was like, I was instantly hooked. And I've played card games ever since. Just how it is. It's just what, you know, in life sometimes things just like hit you. And that was it for me, you know, that I will always play card games, you know.
I'm the same way as you, because there's a lot of games that people will play and play to death. And part of the reason why I'm not as, let's say, attracted to an RPG or something like that is that I miss the adversarial aspect of certain games. I want to play against somebody else. I want to test my mettle against somebody else's and kind of like butt heads in that degree. There's a little extra satisfaction to it, and maybe that's, you know, a bad thing, that it's like I can't enjoy it unless somebody else is losing, but I appreciate the more satisfaction.
Yeah, I mean, for me too, it's always been more than like just winning and losing. It's always been like, this is a something that I can like grow and like get better at, and I can see myself getting better at it. And so it's, you know, that's, I think that's one of the reasons why I've been able to be in competitive gaming professionally, is because like losing like bothers me, but it really doesn't bother me that much. Not as much as like it bothers a lot of other people. I more enjoy sort of the process of like learning, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten better at that as I've gotten older, you know. I think when I was younger, losing bothered me a lot more than it does now, you know. But it never really bothered me all that much. I was never like, you know, yelling at people on Xbox Live or something like that, you know, if I lost.
Me neither. Never.
But,
never.
no, you know, I wasn't doing that. But like, you know, I would get frustrated at single player games when I felt like the game was just like bad. You know, mm-hmm. if I felt like I did the right thing, but their controls sucked or something, you know, that would get me mad. But like if it was me versus someone and I lost, I'd be like, well, you know, I'm just not as good as them right now in that particular moment. So, so like that. So I think I forgot what the original question was. But
oh, well, we were just sort of like shooting the breeze.
I ramble a lot.
Yeah, well, we were just talking more or less about the like what got you into card games and the experience.
Oh, yeah.
And you getting into Womp Radio. Like the reason you're saying like, oh, like I'm glad that you guys had me. I was just saying like between Charmer and I, and you know, how can you say no to an additional 30 years of card game experience? But beyond that is just the perspective of being from other genres of broadcasting and gaming and competition that Charmer and I don't have the same, not nearly as much exposure to from obviously a broadcast perspective, but not only that, but from a competitive perspective. I think that it added so much more. But you're our friend. Like, it just was,
yeah,
it
but
made
we were
sense.
Already kind of hanging out with Flesh and Blood stuff too. So, yeah. Like, because I got involved. How in the world did I get? Oh, yeah, it was Admirable. That's Admirable, who I knew from Hearthstone. He was a Hearthstone caster for a long time. But he got me into Flesh and Blood. And because he was like, you have to play this game. And when I finally tried it, I was like, all right, this game is actually awesome. And he's like, hey, this is this group I know. And so I got connected to you guys through him. But we had already been playing Flesh and Blood. Like, we had met up at like the what Uprising premiere in Vegas a couple of years ago and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so we already knew each other before Star Wars came along, before Unlimited came along, rather. So then, you know, so it was easy to jump into the podcast because we kind of knew each other already, at least. So
we also had myself, you, and I believe it was Andy from BCW were a team for a Team Blitz event. And
or a Rich, right?
Was it Rich? May have been Rich.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm terrible with names.
We did okay. We did well. I mean, the team, I think we went 3-3 as a team, and that's...
I think I threw a couple games that cost us the opportunity to go farther. I feel like I blame our end results on that one. I think we ended up going like 3-3. But I think we could have done better, but I lost a couple games.
It's okay. I mean, like, it's a team game, and like this is the thing, and this is part of it that you kind of mature to as you go through. Like, I'm not a competitor.
It was fun.
It was a lot of fun. That's without saying. I played Chain, which is like, I feel like that's almost like cheating to a degree, but I played...
Dude, I played Briar. Like, did you forget that? Like,
talk about
cheating, you know? Yeah.
But, I mean, so I went 6-0, like, personally, but it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't... I also got a few freebies. It
doesn't matter, but you just had to break that up, didn't,
well,
didn't
this
you?
Is, but
I
this
see
is,
how it is. Yeah.
But this is the maturity that I'm trying to exhibit here is the fact that I also got fed some freebies. Like, I played against two Merchant class, which
you played against two Guinness What You Needs.
Yes, which
is hilarious.
Yeah.
That was the only two in the entire, like, 1,000-plus pool of players for the tournament.
There's, like, 300 teams, and I find the only two that exist. And so those were, like, free passes, because I had a Tier S deck versus basically a meme show. And
one of those games is pretty close, if I remember right, though.
They were, which...
that dude knew what he was doing. Yeah.
Yes, he did. But... we met through that, like in person. Then we casted together at one of the, was it US?
The First Worlds for Flesh and
First
Blood.
First Worlds in San Jose. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now here we are. And now we're dealing with Star Wars Unlimited. And I feel, I'm going to be completely honest here, I feel rejuvenated from a card game perspective. I still have such fondness and so much connection to Flesh and Blood. But... mm-hmm. This is something that's new to me, and it's all, again, it sort of feels like undiscovered country when it involves what is
that's
possible.
That's a Star Trek movie, man. That's,
that is.
Careful about that term. Star Wars discussion.
Let me see. How can I say it? It feels like a Return of the Jedi when there's a brand new card game to be played here. So what are your aspirations, I suppose, for what you want Star Wars Unlimited to be from a competitive perspective? And where there will always be a little bias when it comes to the three of us. I mean, Charber,
sure.
Because of how we are professionally involved with card games. But how do you want this game to look like, let's say, a year down the road?
I think the most important thing to me is that it's still thriving at the local level, that like people are, because right now locals are packed. I don't know a store that's running locals and doesn't have like, you know, 16 people every single week, you know, and that was true in the Twin Cities. That's true in LA since I've been here, at least what I've seen so far in like the month I've been here. So I just want that to continue, right? That's such a healthy sign for the game, you know, for any card game, right? And as far as the, you know, the high end of the competitive side of things, I just want to see kind of like a an open, energetic scene for creating competition. You know, I think it's great that we've got, you know, Fantasy Flight putting together like the Galactic Championship and all that kind of their organized play stuff that they've figured out and that they're putting into play. That's great. But I want to see them being favorable towards other tournaments that come up. And we've seen a bit of that already. We saw 5K just this last weekend with PPG, I think, ran that. Mm-hmm. We saw a couple other ones. There's a 4K coming up in the Southern California in a few weeks. I'm going to go play at that. That's going to be fun. So I want to see like more of that, right? Where I think a competitive game, whether it's a video game or a card game, succeeds best on the community level when the community is able to sort of like shape the competitive side the way they want to, you know? We've had a big problem in esports of game companies coming in and totally dominating their esports scenes. They think that because they made the video game, that gives them license to claim ownership over every community that springs up around their game, which is just kind of arrogant and inaccurate. But so far they have been within their legal rights to do that, and it's only done harm to those esports scenes. So I think new card games like this, can take a lesson from all that and say, yeah, it's great to have the official stuff. It's awesome to see companies supporting their scenes like that. But, you know, keep in mind that support is the key word where, you know, if your community wants to create, you know, more space for competition outside of what you're doing, encourage that, because that means people want to play your game. And if that means that someone out there is going to like charge, you know, tickets to get into the event, or they're going to, you know, have like broadcasts that then people have to pay to access. Well, guess what? Broadcasts cost money. You as the game company who's putting on your own thing should know that. Sure, it's coming out of like your marketing budget or something, but like you're aware that the stuff costs money, right? And so for it to be good, you know, there has to be a way to recoup some of that cost. It's like, you know, basic sports broadcasting, right? So that's what I want to see for this game more than anything is the encouragement of a thriving competitive scene, both within the Fantasy Flight organized play framework and then outside as well. I think there's a lot of potential for that with this game. So I'd like to see it, you know, endorsed, supported. Yeah.
There's always been a lot of discussion regarding casting and casters and you know, style and what makes a good caster, etc. You've got leagues of experience when it comes to casting, and
no pun intended,
maybe a little bit. However, there's a conversation. I had this conversation with Uber on Instant Speed, my Flesh and Blood podcast, maybe a month or two ago, because there was a little bit of debate, or there was actually some bubbled up conversation surrounding what makes a good caster and what kind of qualities or criteria that they should have in order to actually obtain that job. And one of the things that I want to ask you is, do casters have to be pros? And pros, there's no pro tour right now. However, that was the debate for Flesh and Blood, was that why aren't the casters professionally qualified? Why don't they win tournaments themselves? Like, shouldn't they have that? And I'm going to posit this question to you, is should a card game caster be a tournament winning or a top eight worthy or, you know, that kind of quality of player?
I mean, I think a caster should show their quality through their casting, right? I mean, show me another sport where, you know, people demand their commentators are also professional level players of that sport. You know, it's ridiculous to demand that to begin with. That said, I do think to be a good commentator for something like a card game, you absolutely need to understand the game at, if not a pro level, close to pro level. There is certainly a burden of knowledge and skill for commentating a card game successfully, in my opinion, that is higher than, the same level of skill for something like, you know, Fall Guys, if you were going to do like a, you know, a community event or something like that, right? Or even something like Overwatch, you know, or even something like League of Legends. You know, I could play League of Legends all day, every day, and I did for a while, or StarCraft 2, and I'll never be a pro. Like, that's just, you know, I'm just not that good, you know, but I can watch it and I can understand it and I can talk to pros and I can get their opinions on things. I can take lots of notes. I can gather data. I can analyze that and I can bring all that knowledge through on the broadcast. So it depends on the game, right? But no, you absolutely do not need to be a pro to commentate. That is something that comes up in every single game. That's always stupid. But people out there, I've noticed more often than not, people who themselves are nowhere close to pro feel like they're really smart and think, oh, well, why isn't everyone as smart as me on the broadcast? You know, well, to be honest, you're probably not as smart as you think you are. And, you know, on top of that, a commentator is there to inform, but also to entertain, you know, to drive the emotional narrative. I've said this many, many times, but when it comes down to it, people aren't fans of plays. They're fans of players, right? So, and that applies to baseball as much as it applies to Star Wars Unlimited, or Flesh and Blood, right? So the duty of the commentator is to, you know, sure, make sure that analytical side does get brought out. They're able to describe complex things in, clear and concise ways that someone who is not a pro can understand. But the main thing there is to celebrate the accomplishments and the work that the players themselves are putting in, right? And to elevate these people, right? I think another a little issue in commentating sometimes is when the casters want to try to be the stars. Mm-hmm. And it's perfectly fine to be a famous commentator and have people be fans of you. I mean, I have fans. Like I am a famous commentator. In League of Legends, I was arguably one of the most famous commentators at one point. But I always did everything I could to put the players first, you know? And if you do that, I think then whatever, you know, fame or recognitions comes your way, that's great. You know, that's fine, but that's not why you're doing it, right? You're there because you love the stories and you're trying to elevate the players and that's the focus. So it's a long answer to your question, but basically, no, you don't need to be a pro to be a card game caster. You do need to have a high level of knowledge to be a card game caster, but at the same time, there's lots of people that have that high level of knowledge, but don't have the speaking skills to bring it out, right? Or they just talk about it. They talk about the game and they're casting it as if they were talking about the game with one of their high level playing friends. And most of the people that are watching aren't going to be high level players, right? So you're losing a lot of your viewers with just a sort of wall of noise to them where it's like, you know, maybe they go and play casually at locals. They're out there with their IG88 showcase because they pulled it in a pack and that's what they're playing, right? And so, you know, there's a tendency for some newer commentators to want to, like, try to only just show how smart they are, right? And then pat themselves on the back and be like, okay, the entire game of commentating is I have to accurately predict what the player's going to do. And if I did accurately predict it, then I'm a good caster. If I didn't, then I'm a bad caster. And that's completely inaccurate, right? As a commentator for card games, your primary job from the analytical side is to try to bring the viewer into the mind of the player making the decisions and say, you know, if you have access to the hand, here's what's in the hand, here's what's on the board, here's what I know that they're probably thinking about based on, you know, my own knowledge of the game or based on talking to them. You know, what is the line of play they're probably considering and why is that line of play applicable to this situation, right? And so if you can say that stuff in a way that anyone, their grandmother, can understand it, you know, and be entertaining while you're doing it, that's good commentating when it comes to a card game, right? Because we talked about putting the player first initially. Well, if you're spending all of your effort trying to get the viewer into the mind of the player, then that's what you're doing, right? Like even with the analysis, you're talking about what is the player thinking, you know? So I think there's a ton that goes into it, and that could be like a whole podcast series in itself, right? How to commentate a card game or how to commentate anything else. But that's the basics. So yeah, now you don't need to be a pro to cast a card game. You just need to know the game well. More importantly, you need to know how to bring out what the player's thinking and be entertaining about it, you know?
What I want to kind of pick out of this is what you mentioned, wherein, like, if we're going to use a sports analogy here, I can accurately and very specifically say that, okay, this batter at the plate cannot hit a 98 mile an hour fastball. So I can convey this to the people listening that the pitcher should be throwing 98 mile an hour fastballs exclusively. Uh-huh. Does that mean I can throw 98? No, I can't do that, but I know that that's not what needs to be done. Like, there's that's sort of part of the line that needs to be drawn. And you're right, because if we were able to go and win these tournaments, if we were on that level, we'd be out there at these tournaments winning all this money and not commentating for, you know, less than what these people are winning tournaments for.
Depends too. Like I would, you know, even if I was that good, I'd still prefer to commentate because I just like the storytelling. I get more enjoyment out of commentating than I do out of competing at this point, which is weird to say, but I've reached a point, you know, where it's like, yeah, I just like seeing what the smartest people can do. Cause yeah, I mean, I'm never going to be as good as like the best players in this game. You know, I think I can be good and I think I am good right now, you know, but I'm never going to be as good as whoever the Galactic Champion is, you know, this year. I'll try to get as close as I can. But, you know, I have to accept that, like, I don't have the time to grind the way that whoever wins, you know, the big tournaments later is going to have, you know?
There's a lot to be said there, and that's, you're right, is that there's a lot of work that, like, the card games have kind of transcended to where they have to be almost, I don't want to say full-time jobs, but, like, if you're not putting in 20 hours a week into practice, study, innovation, things like that, reps, then you're lagging behind those who put that time in, and it does become a matter of what we're capable of doing. I do want to pull out one other thing that you mentioned, which was entertainment as part of the casting product, because like you said, a lot of what I see, and I've seen this also blow up in people's faces and kind of have a negative reflection on some casters, is that casters are like, we'll go there, and like you said, they'll be like, if I can predict the play, then I'm good at what I do. And if the play that I believe is optimal does not occur, then what I find, and that I think that you have noticed as well, is that sometimes those casters will then say it's a bad play, or it's a misplay, or this was wrong, or whatever. And I feel like that is
Well, that's like the worst thing you can do.
Yeah, that is a chasm that I find that a lot of casters fall into. And I actually, a friend of mine who's been sort of dabbling in it and was doing Lorcana casting fell into that hole where they said, this is not what was supposed to happen. This is not, this is a wrong play, this is a bad play. And they got absolutely torched. And I had to sort of explain to them, I was like, it's not about you. You're not in their mind. I said, you don't know what they're setting up. You don't know what they're thinking. So it's not a wrong play. It's a play that you didn't anticipate. So it's not on you to tell them that they're wrong. It's on you to try to decipher why that might be right and what that might lead to and what the ramifications of that play are. Not that it's wrong.
And I mean, I think there are times where, you know, you can say, you know, well, this was a misplay. But those times when it's so clear that you can say that confidently are extremely rare across any game. And like you said, it's not really your job to say somebody's like, you know, playing bad, right? Or making these mistakes. You know, your job is to help us understand why they did that thing, you know, not just that they did that thing and it's bad. You know, that doesn't give us a lot, right? Where it's because a lot of times, like, players won't just do things randomly. You know, they'll have a reason for doing the things they're doing. Now, there's obviously exceptions where it's like, you know, a player has something that, you know, they obviously should have attacked with, and there's no reason in the world for them to not attack with it. And it's very clear from the board state, and they just don't do it. They grab initiative. And you might see the player be like, oh, you know, you might see some sort of visual indication. Then it's fine to be like, oh, he just realized he didn't attack with that. Obviously, that was damage that was missed and all that. Most any other time when you see something and it looks like a mistake to you, like, never right off the bat be like, oh, that was a mistake. Be like, oh, they didn't do this, or they did this thing. That's interesting. I wonder why they would have done that. And then, you know, try to talk through that with your co-caster and try to figure it out, right? Because that's entertainment, right? Because suddenly everyone at home is going to be like, yeah, I do wonder why they're doing that. And maybe some of them already made up their minds and all that, you know, oh, it was bad. But like, a lot of people are going to be listening to you, you know, their ears are going to perk up, and they're going to be like, yeah, let's try to figure this out. And they're going to be doing that right along with you, right? And that's engaging commentary, you know, where if you've just said that's bad, well, that's it. There's nothing more you can say about that moment. And that's a lot of, you know, potentially lost, you know, intrigue in the broadcast. So yeah, it's extremely rare when it's the right move to say something is just plain wrong.
I'll feel like a missed lethal, like if that, you know, when it's clear, it's a missed lethal. Like,
that's an easy explanation of, or an easy example of something where it's like, they could have won the game, but they didn't, you know, not usually a good reason for that unless they're, you know, like cheating or something.
Yeah. but, another one would be, for example, like an identifying body language. When the sort of the rule of thumb that I use is that if the player themselves, if you can visibly see that they are aware that they made a mistake, then it's okay for you to address that they may have missequenced or misdone or
yeah, you say something like, oh, they don't look happy with that play. It seems like they thought it was a mistake too. That's another thing that you do. It's like, you know, from what I see, it looks like they feel that was a mistake. Because, you know, again, then you're acknowledging that the play may have been a mistake, but you are not the one declaring it to be a mistake. You are saying, you know, you are saying, you know, well, from what I can see, you know.
So how do you feel about the entertainment factor of casting and how much of what, you know, you do, what I do, whatever, has to have a certain element of entertainment? This is one that Uber was very adamant about. He's like, anybody can name the title of a card and how much damage it does. But how are you going to keep somebody engaged in a broadcast when that's all it is? When it's just, you know, when you're just swinging with Sabine for three or something like that. Like, how do you keep things interesting and entertaining when people are trying to sort out what resources that they're going to commit to the board or things like that?
Yeah. I mean, the answer is there's a lot of different ways to do that. And it's not just humor. A lot of people think they hear the word entertainment, they think it has to be humor, which is not accurate. A lot of casters in esports too. You know, I was known, well, I hopefully still am known. I'm known for being on the more humorous side with my commentary, but that's just me, you know. Like, that's not necessarily the right way to cast. That's just how I cast, you know. I know plenty of awesome casters that are not funny people at all, but they're really, really good at explaining complex things in a way that anyone can understand, and they're really good at making you really kind of feel the tension or be intrigued about the decision making. So there's lots of different ways to make it entertaining, right? And there's no real right or wrong way as long as the viewer is engaged, you know? So that's the big one for me is that, like, sure, humor is fine, and I like to inject humor into my commentary, but not everyone can do that. And, you know, even if you can, there's a learning curve when you're starting to commentate where you need to figure out when it's appropriate, when it's not. You know, if you're in the grand finals, you know, you're probably not going to go funny mode, right? Because that's a serious thing for both players, right? You want to treat it with a bit of respect. But, you know, if a moment comes up, you know, and you can seize it, go for it, you know. But you have to know the time. It has to be a good time and place for it, you know.
I know a caster who is very good at what they do, thinks they're funny. That would be Charmer. Definitely. Definitely thinks he's funny.
He's a funny guy.
Yeah, fine, whatever.
He's a funny guy.
All right, so a little bit of a snafu or a life gets in the way scenario. As you can see, we've done a...
My kid woke up.
That's what it was. So we had to complete the recording on the next day. And that's cool. This is kind of like the Oscars, frankly, where we get like multiple wardrobe changes between sort of segments.
That's true. And I'm glad that neither of us are nude, though. You know, speaking of wardrobe changes for the Oscars, in a topical sense, I'm glad that's not the choice that's been made here.
Doa, if I had John Cena's physique, I would not wear clothes. Uh-huh. I would just, like, it would be fine.
I mean, I've had that physique for years, but I still feel like I should wear clothes. So I don't know. He's just showing off, you know.
Okay. I will not vouch for that, but it's okay. So we were going to get into the topic. We were, you know, discussing, you know, various styles of casting, what makes good casting, enjoyable casting, etc. Yeah. But what about the game itself? And I want to ask you, Doa, as somebody who is jumping in full-fledged into Star Wars Unlimited, we've played a ton. There's so much theory crafting going on behind the scenes. What are you enjoying about the game right now?
It's what's funny is that I can honestly kind of say everything, which is weird, because in the past with card games, I've been very much in the aggro vein, aggro slash combo sometimes, in pretty much all card games ever. But this game actually has me playing like control. It has me playing more like mid-rangey tempo. I mean, I've kind of tried a little bit of everything. So what I enjoy right now is kind of everything. I play a lot of Palpatine, play a lot of Boba Fett, but what I'm playing at the moment, and probably, to be fair, enjoying the most, is still aggro. I finally built a Sabine, but I built my own Cunning Sabine list that I've been polishing. I think Cunning Sabine is better than green ECL Sabine overall. And I think people will agree with me more as time goes on, but I'm getting a head start. So I won my last local, only dropped a single game, and I think Cunning Some Bean's really good. I'm going to take the list to a 4K in a couple weeks, and we'll see how it does. But I'm enjoying it a lot, too, because it's there's a lot more you can do with it. It's not as, it's not as, like, in-your-face as, you know, the green version is. It's a little bit more, it's a little bit more cunning, right? You have to be a little bit choosier about what you play, how you play it. I feel like you can go toe-to-toe with more of the mid-rangey decks and have a chance to finish against some of the control stuff. But yeah, it's great. It's such a fun list. I've done some write-ups on the Patreon. Shout out to our Patreon if you're curious about it. But that's what I'm playing the most right now. Although I was challenged to build a Jin Erso deck for my upcoming local this week. So I did that, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, we put some time into that effort. I think you and I spent an hour.
We'll be testing it.
Yes, well, we'll be testing it later this evening. However, so when it comes to Star Wars U and such, again, I have been very much hitched to the Palpatine wagon, and I had a brief stop off in Idenville. However, I'm back on the Palpatine wagon, but there is, you have a 4K or 5K coming up on the 4th of May. May the 4th be with you.
A 4K coming up on the 5th of May.
Oh.
Because they didn't want to overlap with all the May the 4th events, so I guess they're doing a May the 5th.
Okay, that's Revenge of the 5th, right?
Cinco de Mayo, Star Wars United. Star Wars, I keep wanting to say Star Wars United, because we're all united in our love of Star Wars, but it's Star Wars Unlimited. Yeah.
Correct. However, I am eventually going to have to swallow my pride and pick up likely your deck, because I took a some of the store championships around Toronto they sold out in like minutes, and one of them that I wanted to go to on May 4th was sold out, and every 5 to 6 hours I would check the website to see if by some miracle somebody backed out, canceled, refunded, and I checked this morning, no dice. I checked this afternoon, there was one ticket left, and I snagged it. So
nice.
I am going to have to basically bite the bullet, swallow my pride, and play a good deck. So there's a good chance.
Palpatine is a good deck. A Palpatine just top aided the 5K in Kissimmee, Florida.
The Palpatine didn't make it. It was top 16. It didn't make top 8.
Oh, top 16. Okay, yeah. Top 16. That's still pretty good.
It's good. It's
still
good.
Pretty good.
Look, at the end of the day, if I don't have the cards I need for like a Sabine Cunning, which is what I'm leaning towards right now, that's where we're going to go. But that's a different story. But the other question I want to ask you is, besides the standard gameplay, you have also been a little bit, a little pushback towards Limited. However, be it peer pressure or just
this game.
But that's what I want to get to, is because traditionally Limited has not necessarily been your jam, but you have come around.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I'm sounding just like a total shill for this game, but it really has made me like a lot of things in card games I haven't liked before. So I'm happy to sound that way, because the Limited was another thing where I've never been a big Limited player. In other games, I always felt like playing Sealed or playing Draft felt like I was playing a worse version of the deck I would rather be playing. I just have more fun playing a constructed deck. You know, that's the premier format of any card game, I think, is a constructed deck. It's what got me into card games to begin with. So I've never really liked Limited. That said, the Limited experience in this game is different because I play different things. Like, I don't really plan on ever building, like, you know, an IG-88 or, maybe a Chewy constructed deck or something like that. Or an Andor. But, like, I find that in Limited, I end up playing a lot of decks and leaders that I wouldn't normally play, because I just kind of go with what the cards kind of tell me to go with and what leaders I end up getting for its draft. And that's really fun, you know, because you get to experience the game in a very different style, you know, from what you would normally play if you're choosing what constructed deck to build and take to your locals or whatever. So, yeah. So it's kind of converted me in that sense, too, where now I didn't enjoy Limited before, but now I really do with this game.
I think it's just well built. I think the game is just so well positioned to excel in.
Well, it's exciting because I feel like, you know, where a lot of games struggle set to set in terms of how good Limited is, this game with the multitude of leaders, if they keep up with the same amount of leaders and with the way the aspect system works, it really, it could be fun every set. You know, I think Limited could really work every set. So that's exciting.
What are you most excited about when it comes to Star Wars Unlimited?
I play a lot of Constructed, and I love that. Like, competing is the best thing, you know, at the end of the day. But And for me, like, casting is what I want to do eventually. Is I want to cast all the big Star Wars Unlimited matches. That's no secret. I've said it many times. But as far as like playing, I'm really actually excited to play a lot more Twin Suns. Before I moved from Minnesota to California again, I built four Twin Suns decks. I built very thematic ones. I built like a Han and Chewie, Tarkin and Vader, Hera and Sabine, and then Boba Fett and IG-88 were the leader pairs. And I tried to include cards that were thematic with those pairs. And then I just kind of sat down with a couple friends and a couple siblings when we played. And two of them had never played before, but we all had a great time. We played like a bunch of different games one evening and swapped decks between each game. It's like, oh, now I want to play this one now and all that. And all the games kind of all the decks kind of matched up pretty evenly, which is kind of surprising. And like some of the people never played before won games. Some of the people that had played before had won games, but everything seemed very close because you don't want to like fast eliminate someone because then the game ends when you might not be ready for it. So all the games ended up really tight. And the politicking was really fun. So Twin Suns is great. That is a format that I want to play a lot more of and get into building decks for, not in a competitive sense. Competitive Twin Suns, forget about it. Don't even bring the C into Twin Suns. CEDH in Magic, it's an abomination. That is not what Commander was built to do. Commander was built to have fun with, not compete. Don't compete in these formats. Have fun with Twin Suns. I don't want to hear anything about competitive Twin Suns. I want to hear about your coolest, craziest, wackiest Twin Suns deck. That's how the format should succeed. So I'm excited about doing that kind of thing more.
Oh, some of the stories I hear from EDH or competitive EDH specifically, like you said, it's just kind of, you're like, what are you there for? Like, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. Like,
I want to take this fun thing and ruin it. Yeah. That's what competitive EDH is. Yeah.
But the problem is as soon as that there's a winner involved in anything, someone will become competitive about it and kind of look, I am with you on that one. Uh-huh. Let's leave Twin Suns sacred in that regard. And yes, maybe this is just you and I are kind of initial campaign to sort of lobby FFG to just not have official sanctioned tournaments for Twin Suns.
I mean, they can do whatever they want, you know, but like,
I know,
I won't play it. If they made it, I would cast it, because I think it'd be entertaining, but if it was broadcast, I suppose. But like, one of my siblings hates playing Commander, which is really sad, because Commander is the only format of Magic that I really have any interest in anymore, and it's really fun, but he played with a group that was competitive and very toxic, and it just soured him on the format forever, basically, you know. And I don't want that to happen to people in this game. You know, the Twin Suns is such a fun format. I don't want people being out there and being weirdly competitive with this casual format and driving people away from it. So, yeah, keep Twin Suns casual. We should make a shirt that says that. Keep Twin Suns casual. We're making that.
We are going to make it. I actually spoke with Jeff, who is our sort of liaison to our
I'm writing a note right now. You're going to make that shirt.
Keep Twin Suns casual. I think that's a hashtag right there. And yeah. There are a couple questions that came in from our wonderful community. First one coming from our Discord channel. Join the Discord. From Kick saying, what was your relationship with Wizards of the Coast's Star Wars TCG? Were you looking for comfort after Star Wars TCG was shut down and went right into it? Or were you rather blaming the huge corporations for killing CCGs and you skipped TCG?
I avoided that like the plague, man. I had zero interest in playing that game. I've never touched one of those cards. I never will, because I know there's a lot more to the story than you know anyone knows as far as all that went down. I know I don't have all the info as far as how all of that went down with the shuttering of the Decipher Star Wars CCG and then the TCG that happened after that. But, you know, hey, the results speak for themselves, right? I mean, the Star Wars CCG player committee that came about after the official game shut down has existed for 21 years now. They still run tournaments nationwide. They still make their own expansions. There's still live groups that play in the LA area and the Twin Cities, all over the place. Meanwhile, Star Wars TCG, nobody's heard of it, you know? So I think the results speak for themselves. Decipher, Star Wars CCG was great, and it's sad that it died the way it did.
That is a story in itself. The Star Wars, the Decipher,
it lives on, though.
It does, and yeah, more power to them. I will always be there to support them if needed. I'm just glad that it still exists. It's just, it is, if you dig into it, get into the weeds of what happened to Decipher's Star Wars card game, it's pretty gritty, and that's a whole other conversation.
I can't make a statement on that series of events, but I can make a statement on the quality of one game versus the other, and the CCG is by far the better game.
Correct. Another question from Dan Sly. Off the back of Destiny and other Star Wars games that Fantasy Flight have made, what do you think by terms of longevity for Unlimited? Does it have legs to go 5, 6+ years, or will it be short-lived to maybe 3 or 4?
I mean, that's the question, right? That's what everybody's asking with that. Obviously, you know, Fantasy Flight has this reputation that they've kind of picked up where the card games don't end up going for very long. Which is sad because they've made a lot of really good card games. I was really into the Legend of the Five Rings LCG, and that got shut down during COVID. And then I know people have some people have a sour taste about Destiny, which I had never played until fairly recently when right before I moved back to California, Jeremy Zwirn actually sat down with me and taught me how to play Destiny, and it's a really cool game. So I'm sad I missed the boat on that one. I was living in Korea at the time, and just playing card games wasn't a thing many people did over there. But aside from Yu-Gi-Oh, that's a different story. But as far as the longevity of Unlimited goes, I think the only thing you can do is point to what people from the company have said, which has been universally, we're in it for the long haul. People like Tyler Parrott have said that they're already working on like set 9 or whatever, you know. So clearly they're working, you know, years in advance on this thing. They intend to go the long haul with it. I would hope that it works out. I mean, the sales certainly seem encouraging with that. They printed way more than they thought they need, and they sold out, which is too bad for the people that want cards, but really great for the longevity of the game. I'm very optimistic towards it, obviously. I've had a lot of confidence in Fantasy Flight as like good card game makers. It's good game makers for a long time. I've been a fan of their company and their games for many, many years at this point. And this game, I think, is good enough that it's mechanically that it wouldn't even really need to be Star Wars to have longevity. It's just a mechanically well-constructed card game, too. So that's the major point that it's got going for it in its favor. But the other big thing that I like to think about when I think about longevity for this game is the way that they are seeming to be structuring the expansions, where instead of having it be eras in time in the Star Wars universe, which is what things have always kind of been in the past, you know, it's always been like this expansion is the Hoth one, this expansion is this era, you know, they've kind of taken themes instead. And so theme wise, you really kind of don't have any sort of end, right? Because you can pull from different eras, you can have different versions of different characters from different eras that fit that particular theme. We had a very Galactic Civil War era theme for the first set. Now we're getting a very Underworld theme for the second set. We don't know what's happening after that, but that style of expansion, I think, is really smart and will add to the potential longevity of it. So, yeah, I'm very bullish on it. I think it's just a fun game to play, which is the most important thing, but it's got a lot of other things going for it, I think, that will, you know, fingers crossed, make it last a good long time.
I wholeheartedly agree. We had Danny Schaefer on Hello There a couple weeks ago, where he confirmed that they are currently working on set 9. And if we're going to go ahead and, you know, extrapolate that 3 sets per year, if you're on set 9, we are clean and clear through to the completion of 2026. So I think that's, you know, just to answer Dan's question, I mean, we're already past the 3 to 4 year mark on this, and it seems like it's all systems go. I don't see what would ever kind of maybe have them throttle back. Nonetheless, everybody's having a good time with the game. You, myself, Charmer, all of us here at Ice Cave Raider are having a great time, but there are some rapid fire questions, Doa.
All right, let's do it.
All right. You know how to do this. So to sort of like transition us in, I need the finger guns, otherwise it doesn't count.
Oh.
I hope you're still paying attention, because now I'm going to tell you the most important.
Did you need the sound effect? I don't know if you needed that.
Oh, we're keeping that in for sure. That is it. All right. So a little bit of shoot from the hip here, rapid fire style. Be as elaborate or as quick winded as you want. Here we go. What is your favorite line from a Star Wars movie?
That's a really hard one. Why did you ask me? Why do you ask me that? Oh my god!
That's why, because
whatever I say, I'm just going to be disappointed with myself later because I'll think of a different one.
This is called the sleep losing question.
Oh, it is. I will just say, I know.
That's a great one.
It is a great line. Yeah, I have a shirt that says that. Actually, my wife and I got a couple shirts actually, where she has a Leia shirt that says "I love you," and I have a Han shirt that says "I know." So it's a goofy couple thing, but I'll use that. Yeah,
those are goals right there. All right, Doa, let's put it this way. Instead of casting a match, you miraculously go on this absolute tear. You qualify for the Galactic Championship. It's time for the top eight. Now, they're having this in a massive arena, okay? There are 75,000 spectators, gigantic Titantron-style, screen. You're going to be playing in the middle of it, of this entire arena. The lights go down. The fog machine is on full blast. You're about to emerge to play your match. What music is playing? What is your walkout music?
Oh man, that's another hard question. Man.
We ask hard questions here.
I'm such an indecisive person that it's hard to think of these things really quickly. Hums, you'd prefer an astronaut.
Okay. All right.
You'll have to look that up. Nobody knows what I'm talking about.
Well, if we have the rights to the music, we will play it right here.
Oh, all right. Good luck.
All right. Which pet would you rather have? A Rancor or a Kowakian monkey lizard a la Salacious Crumb?
Oh, man. I think the monkey lizard would be a lot more useful. I think, Rancor is the intimidation factor, and they're, they got hearts of gold, we're told, apparently. But the monkey lizard could be like, I could teach it to like make me coffee. I could teach it to be a barista, and, I wouldn't make it need to make me laugh once per day. Otherwise it die. It's like Salacious Crumb's arrangement with Jabba the Hutt. It'd be more like kind of like a roommate kind of situation, I think, where it's like, we just sort of chill, So I don't know. That seems more fun. Rancors, I feel like they'd be too expensive to maintain. Need a bigger area. A lot more food. Monkey lizard, way easier.
Yeah. I feel like a Rancor is like owning a boat. Everybody wants to be the friend of the guy who owns the boat. No one wants to own it. Like, it's too expensive and too much work.
Boba Fett didn't own that Rancor he rode on.
Yeah.
He just, did he? He kind of did. Let's not talk about that.
Yeah. All right, here's this one. How about this one? You've been around within the scene for quite a while. Do you remember what your first autograph that you signed was?
Oh. In esports?
In general.
It must have been 2011 at the GOM TV StarCraft II studio in South Korea. Would have been a fan at that studio, yeah.
Oh my, 2011.
Yep.
All right.
It's been a couple of years.
Doa, who inspires you?
Who inspires me? It's a lot of the... So many people, because no one can be like your one inspiration. I feel like you have to take inspirational things about a bunch of people and see what you can learn from that. People that inspire me, it's going to sound cliche. My dad definitely inspires me as far as like how to be nice, how to look for ways to help people. Just one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. People like Weird Al, Joel Hodgson, these kind of like more off the wall comedians, all the other guys on MST3K, Riff Tracks, that kind of humor has always really jived with me, and I've incorporated a lot of that sort of vibe into what I do on camera. Other people like Adam Savage from the Mythbusters, who people say I look like sometimes, which I don't. I mean, I kind of see it, but I don't really see it. But I love his way of explaining complex topics. I feel like I've learned a lot about speaking about complex things from him. And he's just kind of generally fun guy to listen to. I'll name those people. Yeah, that'll be it. Yeah.
I am a subscriber to Adam Savage's Tested channel.
I love that channel.
He is such a incredibly passionate, inspiring, motivating communicator of, like you said, complex, nerdy things, but you just want to hear him speak. And he's
great. Right. Speakers do inspire me.
He's great. Absolutely amazing. What is your favorite aspect in Star Wars Unlimited?
Aspect? Probably Command. I think, even though I'm kind of shying away from Command because it's like the popular aspect right now, I like a lot of what it does. I like the mix of buffing and ramping and kind of stuff like that. So it's ambush. It's got a lot of fun things going for it. And I, the color green is my favorite color, so I feel kind of drawn to it from that, you know, regard too. So yeah, command.
What is your favorite card of all time from any card game you've ever played?
This is a pretty easy one. I would say the Abyssin in Star Wars CCG.
Oh.
Because there was a ridiculous deck. So in Star Wars CCG, a little bit of story time. In Star Wars CCG, there was no limit on the number of a card you could put in your deck. And so before the defensive shields came out to curb this kind of deck, you could just do something. It's like Relentless Rats and Magic, but it could be like any card. But there's a card called an Abyssin that kind of like buffed each other. They had a leader one that you had them, if you had them chilling at Jabba's Palace, it'd buff everything else, make it very hard to remove. So I had a deck with 32 of them in it. 32 out of the 60 cards was an Abyssin. And I won a tournament with it, and everyone hated me.
I was waiting for it.
Yeah, it was and my light side deck, for those of you who know, you had to bring light side and dark side deck to tournaments, and my light side deck was a Dagobah Drain deck, which was one of the toxic decks out there. I know everyone hated me. I felt great as a winner. I felt terrible as a human being, but the Abyssin was just so much fun because I had never seen anyone build a deck like that, and no one certainly in my scene had thought to build a deck like that. And so when I started playing it, everyone's just like, no, that doesn't work. And then they would lose to it and they'd be like, what is this?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was fun.
For those who are unaware, I want to just give a little bit of context to the pure degeneracy in which Doa is talking here, wherein when you're talking about Dagobah Drain, Dagobah had restrictions where your opponent could not really deploy there. And you would just basically put like a Yoda there. You'd put like a lightsaber. You'd like hit revolution on one of the sites.
You would, if I remember right too, you would use like the cloud location
cloud sectors.
Segments from the cloud sectors from the Cloud City expansion, but you put them on Dagobah because you could put clouds on any planet. And then because the clouds had force icons on each side, but they were on Dagobah, you could drain, but your opponent couldn't deploy there. So it was very toxic and annoying, and those two decks are one of the reasons why they invented the defensive shields down the line,
mm-hmm.
where you could just have the essentially you had a sideboard of cards from outside the game that you could bring in with an effect if someone was playing that kind of deck to like shut down a big part of it and make it manageable, because it did get to the point in that game where there were decks that were just crazy, out of control, cheap, and but it was fun.
did you ever how many sense alter controls did you play in that deck?
That's a good question. I can't remember.
But it was a bunch, right? Like it was a ton.
Yeah, I mean, not a ton. You wouldn't need a ton. It was more just you wanted to draw Abyssins, and then there was like the what is it, Nalhada Charm or something like Abyssin Ornament was one. Mm-hmm. There were a couple things that would bring them back. That was what made it really work, is that you could bring them back from the lost pile. So you were constantly recurring
and
the Abyssins.
Retrieve.
And they had a really high forfeit value. So you would overwhelm them on the ground in a big way. And you just spread out across Tatooine and just force drain them and if they couldn't fight you, you know? So yeah, I think I had a couple big ships, you know, probably just your standard package of control, alter, sense, you know, maybe like two or three of each, probably three control. I think that was at the time the most useful of the three, but not a ton, but you didn't need a ton because you had a lot of other more annoying cards to use.
I love it. All right. I'm going to give you a little choice to make here. You have been granted the power of teleportation. However,
cool.
You have to select one of two caveats to it. The first is that if you teleport from point A to point B, you have to choose. It is instantaneous. However, you are fatigued as if you sprinted that whole distance. Or it is not instantaneous. It will take the same amount of time will pass, however, not in your mind, that in which you would, as if had you sprinted that location. So let's say you're going from here to like 2 miles down the road. It could be instant, but you are absolutely gassed as if you ran the whole way. Or it is not instant and the time would have passed between you going and getting there, but you are not fatigued. Which would you choose?
I mean, neither of those sound good. I would rather just like travel normally at that point. But I would choose, I guess I'd choose one that didn't leave me fatigued, because if I was, you know, if I am fatigued on the other end, I'm probably tired for like that amount of time anyway. So I might as well get there fresh, you know?
Okay. I would have gone with the fatigue part because I could just go across the street and just impress people, like play catch with myself and just anyway. Two more. First, second to last one here is Doa. What is your secret talent?
My secret talent? I can juggle a little bit, but not very well. Maybe my secret talent actually, I haven't talked about it a ton, but I used to skateboard a lot to the point where like I was skating with some of the pros in my area, and like I was kind of in talks of being sponsored by some of the there was like a deck company maybe, but that was like high school and college. But I wasn't like the greatest skateboarder, but I was like good enough to at least hang, you know, with some of the really good skateboarders. Like the best trick for context, the best trick I could do would be like a 360 flip, which is pretty good. That's not an easy trick. At least it wasn't an easy trick for me to do. But I like to do a lot of like body varial stuff was my favorite type of trick to do, because I just seem to be like better at those than like the flip tricks anyway. But yeah, so I don't know. Maybe skateboarding, I guess. I still ride around a little bit, but like I don't do tricks anymore. This old gamer body can't take it.
I like how we went from I guess I could juggle too. Oh yeah, I used to do like 360 flips on a skateboard.
Well, I didn't know if that was like a secret thing because I'd kind of talked about it, but I guess I haven't talked about it much. So
I didn't know about that.
Oh, there you go.
But you look like a juggler, if that makes any sense.
Thanks.
I don't know. All right. Last one, Doa. Skittles or M&M's?
Oh, well, I mean, can we clarify what kind of Skittle or M&M?
You can.
Is this just the base model? Or
you
is
could
this...
select any variant of either or.
I mean, I think peanut M&M's are superior out of all forms of Skittles and M&M's, unless you're allergic to peanuts, of course. But I think otherwise you have a good mix of, you know, some sugar, but some protein. You know, it's not pure unhealthy, you know, snack. Whereas like I love sour Skittles, but that is just like all sugar and like corn syrup and stuff. So, you know, I just can't endorse that. But yeah, peanut M&M's probably a superior choice there.
Continuing to win on the M&M train. I love it. And that's it. Doa, thank you so much.
Oh, great.
That's all. Look,
my pleasure.
Easy peasy. But I figured it was definitely worth getting to know our Wampas a little bit better. So thank you so much for being on. Hello there.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. And now we say bye-bye then. See you next time on Hello There.
So uncivilized.